This is the Making Good Podcast, episode 35. Welcome to the Making Good Podcast with me, Jen Gale. Stay tuned for inspirational stories from ethical and social entrepreneurs and people making good stuff happen in their communities, as well as tips, tools, and techniques to help you grow your ethical business and amplify your impact. Hello, hello. Welcome to the Making Good Podcast. As always, I am super excited about today's interview and about sharing it with you. In this episode, I'm chatting to Emily Matheson, who is the founder of Arende, a social enterprise which has the tagline of life-improving homewares. How cool is that? The word Arende means care in Old English, and it perfectly reflects the attention and the thought that Emily has given to every single piece in this carefully curated online homewares shop. All of the products are not only beautiful, but they're made in the UK by people facing social challenges. Arende has just celebrated its first birthday, which is exciting. And in this episode, Emily kind of lifts the curtain to reveal some of the realities of starting up a social enterprise and some of the challenges she's faced during this first year. I think it's all too easy sometimes to see other businesses, especially ones as beautiful as Arende, and assume that they must be huge financial successes. But this isn't always the case. And although Emily and Arende are doing brilliantly, it's really important to remember that they're only in their first year, or they've just come to the end of their first year. And the traditional model of business is that most businesses don't start to turn a profit until they're 3 years old. And I think we forget that really quickly when we're starting things on a bootstrap. Emily and I are both really passionate about the need for all businesses to be good businesses and to shift towards the social enterprise model. And there's a point in the conversation where we both talk about the responsibility almost of forging a path and proving that this model of good business works, not only from a social impact viewpoint, but from a financial one too. If we can show people, if we can prove that people can make good money and make good stuff happen at the same time, that's when things will really start to shift. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. So as ever, do drop me an email on jen@jengale.co.uk or come and join in the conversation over on Facebook in the Making Good Facebook community. And I'll link to that in the show notes. Oh, and I've just remembered that at one point during the recording, Emily's phone goes off and I don't have the skills as yet to edit that out. So please do forgive that little blip, but we were mid-flow in the conversation and we really didn't want to stop. So just bear with on that one. And a final PS from me. If you're looking for support with your ethical business or your social enterprise, if you feel like you're really clear on the impact you want to have, but maybe not quite so clear on how to get there and make a living at the same time, then I'd love to have a chat with you about how I might be able to help support you with that. So do drop me a line. Again, the email is jen@jengale.co.uk. Now I'll leave you to enjoy this interview. Take care. Hello, Emily. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. Hi, Jen.
Brilliant. Welcome so much to the show. It's fabulous to have you here. And there's so many things we've just been talking about, the different things we might dive into and so many different things. But first up, the most important bit is the tortoise.
Yes. Could you just...
We have a tortoise affinity because I've got a, I think she's about 78 now. We've got the 78-year-old tortoise. And you said that you've just hatched a baby tortoise.
We've got a new baby tortoise who's 3 days old now. And still hasn't fully come out of its shell.
Oh, really?
So crawling around with a shell on its back in a very cute way. And it's called Mo.
Mo.
Named after Mo Farah.
Because ours is called Speedy, which is the same irony.
Similar theme. And if it turns out to be a girl, apparently we are going to adjust its name to Moana.
Oh, and are you going to keep it, him, her?
We are going to see how it goes over the next few weeks. We've turned the heating on for the tortoise, but the humans in the house are not allowed the heating on yet. So
was that a cunning ruse? I might get a baby tortoise next autumn so we can have the heating on.
Yeah, exactly.
It must be quite a responsibility, because I feel quite a responsibility when our old tortoise, you know, goes into hibernation, or, you know, is she eating, is she doing this, and there's just the tiny little baby one must be so vulnerable.
Well, yes, it's like I was just saying to my mum, it's a bit like having a newborn again, running around checking temperatures and hoping that it's warm enough and not too cold and eating enough and drinking enough. Yeah. And yes, I thought tortoises were going to be slightly less labour-intensive than it has been. But at least they don't cry.
Yes, yeah, there's always that. Can't wake you up at night.
Yeah.
If you've got a picture, you'll have to send it to me to put in the show notes, because I so want to see a picture of this.
I will do.
Mo with half an egg stuck to his bottom. Brilliant. Okay, right. On with the proper stuff. So can you, we know you've got a baby tortoise. Can you introduce yourself to us and tell us a little bit about Arende?
Of course. So my name's Emily Matheson. I'm the founder of Arende, and this is a social enterprise that launched last year. We sell homewares and interior products, and everything is made in the UK. Everything is made by hand, and everything is made by people facing social challenges. That covers quite a wide array of what would widely be considered marginalised groups, or people that don't often have an opportunity to have their craft skills recognised. So that might be adults with learning disabilities, or it might be prisoners, or people with visual impairments, refugees, and basically anyone who might face barriers to accessing conventional employment.
Wow. And your background is as a journalist, isn't it? How did that leap come about?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've always been interested, I guess, in social justice. You know, as a teenager, I was a member of Amnesty and Greenpeace and various other charities and organisations. And I think I went to university and I got into journalism, and it was wonderful, but a bit sort of a sidetrack, I guess. I was working in luxury lifestyle and travel journalism, and it was incredibly glamorous and exciting, but once I had my children, some elements of that started to feel a bit more practically difficult to do. And I was very, very interested in interiors. And I think because I'd worked in lifestyle publishing for so long, I really had a very sort of strong visual idea of what I wanted to create. But because of my history, I kind of knew about the problems of capitalism and consumption, and didn't really want to have a kind of interiors brand or shop that was just, I guess, contributing to what I feel is part of the problem, which is that we just buy relentlessly without thinking very considerately about what we buy. So I spent a long time thinking, how could I launch something that not only had environmental integrity, but that also had a social value? And it was when I came across Camp Hill Village Trust, which is a charity that provides residential support for adults with learning disabilities, that I really started to, that the idea started to really percolate. They offer a range of really amazing sort of craft facilities for their residents, and they produce gorgeous things, but like many charities, maybe don't have an idea about branding or marketing or press. And that was something that I was very confident I could do very well, having worked in the industry for such a long time. So that was sort of where it started, and then I began to research other social enterprises who had a sort of making output. And I think this is a sort of misconception a bit about social enterprise, that it's always just about services, but it's something that happens behind the scenes. And so I really wanted to try and find social enterprises that had a sort of direct to consumer offering. And found some. And yes, some of our products are designed by me and commissioned by me, and some of our products are things that are already being made. And I put them together all on a website, very, very carefully curated, beautifully photographed, and very much with the idea that they have to be products that I would want to have in my own house. so that I can really promote the idea that there is a, you know, a quality and a style and a beauty to these products. And that, I think, is how we'll challenge the stigma around some of our makers more effectively than just having a sort of broad shop that sells everything.
Yeah. As it were. Yeah, yeah, yeah. God, there's so much I want to dive into there. So let's start off with social enterprise and what that means to you, because it's one of those slightly woolly terms. Some people mm-hmm. won't have heard it before, and it means different things, doesn't it, to different people. What's your definition?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question. I hadn't really heard about social enterprise before I started researching the business. And, you know, I still think it's not very sexy.
Yes.
Really. Yeah. And that's a sort of issue, I guess, for all of us as social entrepreneurs. But it was when I was starting to think about how to set the business up and how to really, I guess, show the integrity of the business, that I came across social enterprise and this idea of business that helps people or the planet. Yeah. And that everything we do conforms to, you know, the conventional ideology of a social enterprise. But I think maybe what's interesting about Arendi is that it wasn't, you know, I'll be completely honest here, it wasn't totally altruistic. It wasn't born out of identifying the social problem.
Yeah.
It was born very much out of my personal desire to have an interior shop and then to make that as socially and environmentally beneficial as possible. So I maybe approach it from a slightly different perspective than a lot of social entrepreneurs. And I think I promote it in a different way as a result. So I don't necessarily come from a business background, but I do very much come from a branding and storytelling background. And so I'm just trying to unite that experience with the social enterprise world, which is excellent at doing good, but not always so good at telling the stories.
Yeah, definitely. And that branding and that, it just come, you know, the site just, you said, oh, social enterprise isn't very sexy. The site, sexy is the wrong word, but the site looks sophisticated. It looks like a brand. It looks it looks curated, which is, you know, you said it is very heavily curated. And
there's always more to do. But yes, I mean, it's very important to me that if someone comes to the site that they instantly feel attracted to the products and that they think that they're desirable and that the social purpose is almost like the extra reason to buy the product, but it's the product itself that people want. And then when they found out the backstory and the way that we run the business, that is just an extra feel good for the customer.
And yeah, that's one of the things I was going to say, is that it's almost, it looks like a air quotes normal sort of interiors website, mm-hmm. and then it's a kind of like, oh, by the way, do you know, mm-hmm. like we're doing all this we're supporting all these amazing awesome organizations at the same time, and I guess that helps with that sort of added value and that sort of why should people buy from me type thing. But people come primarily because you've got beautiful products and it's very well laid out and aspirational, I guess.
Well, I hope so. And I really think that this is the challenge for social entrepreneurs, is to, you know, market yourself in competition with, as you say, in air quotes, conventional mm-hmm. retailers. And I think if we can't do that, then it's very hard to be sustainable. But what is so nice about the brand for me is that there's always something to talk about. So I can talk about the product, as all retailers can, but I can also talk about the maker because I know them personally. I can talk about, you know, materials and how we source them because we do that and everything's very traceable. And I think that, you know, it absolutely is not the case that being a social enterprise and having social impact has to be a hindrance, but it's about working out where the benefits are and how to integrate them with your brand so that they become a selling point, if not the only selling point.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's interesting what you say about almost approaching it from almost the other way to what many social entrepreneurs which might be, I've got a passion and a purpose that I'm really, really want to promote. Really, I can see a need. I can see it. So how do I monetize that? You've kind of mm-hmm. almost gone the other way in that I want this. How can I make it do as much good as possible?
It's exactly that. Yes.
Yeah. And there's a really interesting thing that I'm always really torn by as well, in that you mentioned about this thing around consumerism and around wanting, I guess, to have lovely things, or in your case, you know, wanting to be able to sell lovely things, but actually realizing that consumerism is a really big problem, and without wanting to kind of be, you know, how do you sell stuff without contributing to that problem? And I think coming at it from this very thoughtful place, very kind of well-rounded place, you're not selling stuff for the sake of stuff. You're selling stuff and it's benefiting people, but it's also really carefully thought out stuff that hopefully people will give a lot of thought and care into putting into their homes, and they're not just going, oh brilliant, it's a mug. Do you know?
Well, exactly. You know, we've tried really hard. I've tried to make sure that the collection mainly features items that are useful and that they, you know, conform to the William Morris adage that things should be useful or beautiful.
Yes.
Inevitably, when you're focusing on interiors, there will be some what I think of as, you know, the gifty items. Mm-hmm. They're very popular. And of course, I can't argue that anyone really needs a scented candle. But I do think that, you know, that beauty has a, you know, a wider purpose, and that it can be good for us, good for the, you know, soul of the consumer, yes, as well as having the positive impact on the maker. So, you know, it is a conflict, but I try really hard in the way that I market the brand to say, look, don't just buy this stuff just because you want loads of new things. Buy one of our plates because you need a new plate, and then you'll keep it forever, and you'll find out the name of the person who made it when you receive it, and you can really feel connected to that process, and it becomes, you know, an item to cherish in your home rather than just an object without any sort of emotional connection or identity.
And I think that's one of the advantages, I guess, of buying something or having something that's, like you said, been made by a person that you can kind of name and that you know, and you know where the stuff's come from, is that stuff has that story, and therefore you own that stuff in a much more whole way. Does that make sense?
I completely agree. Yeah, and lots of mainstream brands are trying to work out how to do this, and actually this is where we've got a huge advantage, because you know, all of us social entrepreneurs, because, you know, it's very hard for a mainstream brand to tell a story about a product that they don't know anything about. But, you know, I can really, you know, I can talk about my tea towels. I know where the fabric's made. I've asked lots of questions. I know the people that sew it. We buy the cotton together. And, you know, that just, you know, for me, when I buy something, that's what I want to know.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether it's my clothes or my, you know, dinner or my plate or whatever, I want to know where it's come from and who was the farmer or, you know, who made it. And so what we're trying to do is bring some of that awareness that people have around ethical fashion and food and really apply it to the interiors industry, which I think not many people have thought about in that sphere before.
Yeah. And that's kind of like the Fashion Revolution campaign, you know, encouraging people to ask who made my clothes. And you said that the big brands don't necessarily know that story or aren't able to tell that story. And I think even if they do know that story, and that can be really hard to know exactly who's made it because everything gets subcontracted out, they're probably not particularly keen to tell it because it's not one that we want to hear. Whereas you can be proud of your story, you can own that story, and people who buy it can be proud, can own that too.
Exactly. And I love it when people ask questions. And I actually like it when people ask, you know, almost quite negative questions, because it really gives me a chance to come back and tell in more detail maybe than I do on the site about how we operate. I see it as an opportunity to kind of showcase all of the things that I think that we do that are really valuable about the way that we do business.
Yeah.
And people do give, you know, I think social entrepreneurs a hard time. They expect you to be all ethical business. They expect you to be above reproach in every single way. Yet for a conventional retailer, no one
asks any questions.
Not so many people ask the questions. And, you know, I think it's quite good to be held to account in that way. And it's really good to think about which compromises do we need to make and which ones, you know, should we let go by the wayside?
Yeah. And I think as long as you're, I know this is something that some people get a bit overwhelmed by, in terms of they almost don't want to promote the ethical things that they're doing because they think they will get people coming and saying, oh, well, hold on a minute, you're saying you're ethical, but you're not doing X, Y, and Z, and feeling like they have to go from where they are now to, you know, a B Corp or, you know, some real kind of accredited, certified, ticking every box company. But actually, I think it's more of a journey, and I think it's more about doing the things that you can do and being transparent about the things that you're not doing but the showing that you're aware of them and that they are, you know, there are plans in place.
I completely agree. And I think it is about awareness. I mean, the idea that you can only do what you can do. Sometimes I think, yeah, that's great. And sometimes I think, yeah, but if I know that that thing is causing harm or upset somewhere down the line, it's very difficult to say, okay, I won't do organic cotton this time because yes. I can only do what I can do. But at the same time, you have to start somewhere. Yeah. And if what we do makes one person think differently about their use of organic cotton or linen, then that's a good thing.
Yeah, definitely. And I think if you, taking that organic cotton example, I guess if you could say, it's almost saying to your customers, look, we're not using organic cotton this time because X, Y, and Z, but, you know, by this time, but in 6 months' time, we will be using organic cotton. And saying at some point we would love to use organic cotton. It's like,
yes, this being is clear. Yeah. But it's also, I mean, I think one of the things that I've actually decided is that I do want to use organic cotton, and that the onus then is on me to find consumers who understand that and pay the extra for it, or to provide enough information so that people understand why they're paying extra. Yeah. So those accusations of something being too expensive. Yes. Start to make sense, and that's really what I'm trying to do is to create more of a premium product rather than trying to match the prices to everything that's available on the high street and hope that we can operate in the same way, because we just can't.
No, and that's one of the things I was going to ask you about, is this concept of the ethical premium. And it makes it sound like, you know, when you get married or you have a baby and somebody slaps wedding on the front of cake or wedding on the front of stationery and suddenly it's three times as much. It makes it sound like, when people talk about an ethical premium, it makes it sound like somebody's just putting ethical in front of something and hiking the price up by three times. And actually, it costs that much because it's the true cost. It's a true reflection of how much things cost. Mm-hmm. And I think how we dispel that myth that there's this kind of, oh, we're just going to slap ethical on something and that's why it charges more, because we've called it ethical.
Well, I think ethical is a tricky word, and I think it's very overused, and there's a lot of people that call themselves ethical retailers, and when you sort of look onto their websites, you know, what is it that's ethical? I can't really understand it. And, you know, for me, one of the things that we're trying to integrate onto the site is how long it takes to make things. Mm-hmm. So if we've got a wooden spoon that costs £20, and people say, gosh, that's a lot for a wooden spoon, we can say, well, look, this has taken half a day just to make, and that doesn't include the materials. Yeah. How much would you want to be paid for your half a day of making a spoon? And that's a sort of equation that people can instantly identify with. So rather than just using the word ethical, I'm really just trying to provide more information so that people can understand what that price means. And that there is also, as with fashion, and a bit with food and restaurants, is that there's a value in having something that there aren't very many of. Yeah. And if there are only five of those spoons in the world, then, we should, that's a selling point. Yes. And it's more because of it.
Yeah, definitely. And you talk on the site as well about the power that we have as consumers to affect social change. And that's one of the things, you know, that I'm really passionate about, and that you're surrounded or living as we do in this world of consumerism. There's that quote, isn't there, about every time you spend your money, you're casting your vote for the kind of world you want. And I think if we can remember that each time we're opening our purses, it's so profound almost, isn't it? And how do you see that? You've said that's one of the things you've written about. What's your take on that?
Well, I completely agree with you. And, you know, I think it is the single most important thing we can do, whether your main concern is, animal welfare or the environment or people, it's very important. And I, again, one of the things that I do myself is I really try and think through my purchasing. And I'm like, of course, I'm a human being. I'm not above reproach. People think that I'm going to dress head to toe in, fully ethical.
Yeah.
Inverted commas clothes. I don't do a lot of shopping because I think shopping is probably the worst thing you can do. And actually, I often think that one of the best things you can do for the world is nothing.
Yeah.
Because most of the ways that we spend our money tend to do harm. But the way that I approach it when I go shopping is I think, is my short-term happiness or convenience in the purchase of this product going to have a negative impact on someone else down the line? And normally the answer is yes. So what I want to make sure is that the things that I'm selling, that, you know, the answer is always no if someone else is asking those questions. And it's not just about the product. And I think this is a really important thing to me, is it's about the whole way that I run the business. So, you know, for example, you can have a company like, you know, Adidas, that sells a very innovative trainer made from bits of plastic sifted from the ocean. And I love that idea, and I'm pleased that they're doing something. But if a lot of their other manufacturing practices are exploitative or based on slave labor,
don't worry.
That, you know, it undermines the good that they're doing. So for myself and for Arende, it's really important that it's not just the bits of the business that you see, but it's about our customers knowing and I guess feeling assured that I've thought of everything. So whether that is the fact that the stickers that go out on our packaging are biodegradable, or the fact that we bank with the cooperative because it's really important that our money is not spent on things that we disagree with, so that it's every element of the business and it's integrated and holistic. It's about caring about all of the things that we do and how we treat people, and not just the making of the product.
Yeah. God, I could whittle on at you or with you about all this for so long, because it's just, completely my cup of tea, totally. But you've recently celebrated your first birthday, haven't you, which is super exciting.
Yes. We made it.
And we were talking before we kind of hit record and started on the episode for real about almost sort of lifting the curtain a little bit on the reality of a startup business. So how has that first year been?
I mean, unbelievable in positives and negatives.
Right.
So I think that my naivety about business was what enabled me to launch Arende. If I'd known what I know now, I think that I might have thought a little bit more about it. But I was also given the same advice that you were given, which was that if I waited, it would never be perfect and that I had to start. And I think that was very good advice, because it's such a steep learning curve. There are so many parts of business that I realize now I was really a bit arrogant. I just thought, well, I can set up a shop, I can get some nice things, I can make it look nice. And that's just not always the way that it works. So we started with initial funds of, they were crowdfunded, and that was a very sort of successful crowdfunding campaign. But it was only £5,500. I say only. When I did my very rough accounts at the beginning, I worked out how much it would cost me to buy the products that I wanted to sell. And that's all I did. Which was incredibly naive. And it meant that once I'd bought all the products, of course, I didn't have any money for packaging. And I didn't have any money to, you know, for heating my office. And I didn't have any money to pay myself. And so, I really think that this financial planning is such a crucial thing that lots of socially minded business people really struggle with. That for me has been the hardest part of the journey, learning about cash flow and working out how to make your orders with manufacturers effective, and volume control, and all of these things, these terms, ROI, that I never really thought about. I just thought, if I build a beautiful website full of beautiful products, people will come. And I have been very lucky, and they have come. And we, you know, I turned that £5,500 into a turnover of around £20,000 in the first year. But it, you know, it's not that simple. I haven't, obviously, haven't just got £15,000 in the bank. There's been so many, you know, unforeseen expenditures, and they can be tiny things. All the train journeys and car journeys you make to makers, and the meetings, and the bills that you have to pay and the courses that you maybe attend. And so I feel that, you know, we could really support each other as an industry if we talked more about that. Because I think in conventional business, that's the first thing everyone's talking about. Mm. What are your profit margins?
Yes.
How, you know, what's your unit price of this? What's the volumes? And they just talk in this kind of Dragon's Den language. Yes. That we maybe aren't very good at or familiar with, because we talk in the language of social value.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think one of the things that I'm trying to get better at is to really think more like a conventional business person.
Yeah.
While maintaining my commitment to social and environmental yeah. impact. And I don't think that they have to be mutually exclusive, but it is something that you can't ignore if the business is to become financially sustainable over yeah. a longer period of time.
Yeah.
One of the things we were talking about that you said was this idea of it taking 3 years for something to make a profit. And I think that probably is true. But of course, in my financial planning and in my head, I just thought, yeah, I'll be making money straight away.
Yeah.
And I have not been able to take a salary this year. And it's lucky that I have a sideline job as a journalist, because I've been able to do freelance writing mm-hmm. and that's enabled me to help pay the bills. But I also need to put all of my energy and focus into the business. And yeah. so that's the plan for year two, is to really be more rigorous with the finances and the monetary planning and the kind of strategy part of it now that it's up and running.
Yeah. And I think I did an interview with a guy called Ryan, who's brilliant. He's an accountant, but he has a social enterprise as well. And he just made, because I'm the same about figures. I you know, I did maths A-level, I can do figures, but these business terms are very alien, they're very scary, I guess, because they're unknown, and I don't understand them, and my brain just sort of switches off. And he just made it so practical, and so actually it's goal setting, but it's goal setting with numbers. And mm-hmm. actually you need to know what's going out each month so that you know what you need to bring in each month.
Of course. Then
you know what your revenue streams are, so how many of them do you need to sell to make that amount of money? And it is actually really, you know, you can boil it down, I'm sure you can overcomplicate it, but you can boil it down to its kind of simplest thing. But I think that's a bit that we all kind of miss out, maybe, or you know,
it's such a
over.
Crucial part. And I think that you know, one of the other things that I've really learned in this last year is that creating a business on your own, although I work with all these wonderful charities and other social enterprises and makers, it is basically me on my yeah. own, putting it all together, trying to make every decision. Yeah. And I think one of the major things I would change if I was doing it again would be to have found someone with yeah. a completely different skill set to mine to do it with, mm-hmm. so that we were both moving in the same direction, but uniting different sets of skills that yeah. would enable the business to be successful. And so that's something that I'm looking into now, is how to find someone that can bring more of that sort of business
yes.
financial mind to Arende,
yeah.
so that I can focus on the bits that I'm really good at and the bits that I enjoy.
Yeah. And is there anything that you have outsourced over the year, the website build or the social media or anything of that, or is it all...
No.
Wow.
I mean, I have now got an accountant who is helping me. And I think this is, you know, one of the other things about, related to the making money, is that you feel very nervous about paying people to do things because you want to keep the money yeah. in the business yeah. and you want to be able to keep things ticking over. But actually, you get to a point where you realize that you become the bottleneck
yeah.
and
yeah.
you have to recognize what you can't do. You know, as with the money, you can't have any social impact if you're sitting at a desk having a panic attack because you haven't done something. I am now starting to spend some money on particularly accounting and a bit of financial strategy, because I need guidance in yeah. that area. And increasingly, I will start to spend that money on assistance with, you know, digital marketing and SEO and Facebook advertising and all of these things. But when you've launched something on your own, you've had your fingers in every bit of it, yeah. and it can be quite hard to let go.
It's your baby, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. Learning which bits to step back from yeah. so that it can grow is really, really important. And that's part of nurturing the business, is not always being completely involved. It's knowing when to pass something over to someone else.
Yeah. And I think there's something very scary as well about knowing or spending the money and trusting that it will come back, you know, like outsourcing that to release that bottleneck so that the business can grow, and trusting that it will come back. And I think the temptation is to go, I just can't afford that just yet, and hold on to it and hold on to it. And actually that's meaning that you don't get to a point where you can afford it as quickly as you might.
Of course, well, you have to have the long view, don't you? I mean, you know, it's very easy to say, well, if I spend some money on this strategy and it's going to cost, you know, X hundred pounds for 2 days support, it's very hard to be able to translate that into sales anytime shortly after.
Yeah.
But it's about, I think it's, you know, thinking about sort of structures, you know, for business, which is that you have to have a really solid foundation if you're going to be able to, you know, flourish, I guess. And those elements of business are as important as the product and as important as the marketing and the branding. You have to have, you know, the financials in place. Yeah. And I've learned that now. And so this year it's about solidifying that part of the business so that we can grow and do better and help more people next year.
Yeah. And that's one of the things we were talking about, wasn't it, beforehand, was that whether it is just a kind of social enterprise thing or an ethical business thing, but this almost guilt over being seen to make money out of doing good and feeling like you shouldn't, or you should be doing everything for free, or but actually the way Arende is set up, in that you are a showcase for all these brilliant products made by all these amazing people, do you find that that guilt is somehow, well, I'm assuming that you feel it, but that it's helped because you can directly see the more successful Arende is, the more successful you will, these the more these people, you can lift them up.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I actually don't feel guilty because I know how much money is being paid to them.
Yes.
And they're all making good money out of Arende.
Yeah.
As they should be.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the time when I can make some money, no, I won't feel guilty at all. I mean, I feel that obviously I think it's a great idea, but I am, you know, I work harder than I did in my old job,
yes,
and I made good money. And I feel that, you know, these kinds of businesses have an impact beyond just the makers. You know, I feel like if consumers are thinking differently about how they might buy products for their home, then that is this sort of extra element of social impact. And I, you know, that has a value, and there are a lot of skills and hard work involved in setting up a business, and that you should absolutely be compensated for that. It just doesn't make sense to me, the idea that, you know, if someone works for John Lewis or IKEA doing, you know, a really important job for them, everyone's totally fine with them earning a salary. But when you try and do something good, people think you shouldn't. And I think that sometimes the social enterprise sort of sector doesn't help itself. There's a lot of expectation that people will do things for free, that we will go and we'll talk for free, and we'll run workshops for free, and we'll come and show off our products. And you know, I've tried really hard to say no to quite a lot of those things, because once you go down that route, it's very hard then to start saying, actually, no, if I'm going to come and give a day of my time and someone is going to benefit from my expertise, then you have to pay me for that. And it's not always very comfortable. But I think it is a way of valuing what we have to offer. And actually, what we have to offer is, you know, the future of retail or business, I believe. And so we should promote ourselves in that way, and as having that value.
And also what you just said there made me think there's a certain element, I guess, of responsibility in terms of proving that this business model can work, and that this is a good way to do business, and that people can make a living from this, and it can be a good living, and that it's benefiting in so many other ways as well. And as you said, if that is to be the future of business, which, you know, I believe it needs to be, then we need to have these models that prove that it works.
Exactly, exactly. And you know, you wouldn't ask someone from, a high profile business to come and speak at a conference for free. And this idea that we should always want to do things for free because it's promoting something, it's a false economy for our own businesses. And obviously, you have to make a call on each individual situation. And there are some where it may feel that it's worth it. But I see a lot of people on the kind of forums and discussions that I follow really giving up a lot of themselves for not very much financial compensation. And you can't live like that for very long. So, again, it's going back to what I said earlier about trying to be more rigorously business-like in approach while maintaining, the integrity and all of the positive elements of the business also.
Yeah. So in terms of this year, and you said that, sort of looking back, whether it's a bit like having kids, if I knew now, it's that kind of, it's the naivety that gets you through it. And you said that having a business sort of strategy partner would have been invaluable in that first year. What are the other lessons learned along the way?
Well, I guess the other thing is, there's that sort of the idea in business that if you're going to fail, you have to fail fast.
Yes.
And I do like that idea. But the reality is, it's not always possible to do that. If you buy something and it doesn't sell, how do you fail fast at that? That's a kind of learning process. And it's also working out how you market those things. So I think one of the other things that I've learned is that you can take too much advice
and that
sometimes you just need to have an instinct about what is the right way forwards. And when you don't come from a business background, it can be quite hard to trust that instinct.
Yeah.
But it is important, yes, to read the advice. But I think I got very bogged down in how I should be doing something. And then it sort of leads you away from the core of what your business is. It's about navigating the right path for you as a business person or, an ethical entrepreneur that makes sense and that feels natural. Because if you're not doing something that feels right, then it's going to show all the way through your business.
Yeah.
And so I think that's one of the other things that I'm trying to do while being a little bit more structured and focused in some areas, to kind of switch off that must absorb all advice kind of openness to everything, because it can be really confusing when you're not very experienced to know which bit of advice to follow and which bit not to.
And there's so much advice out there, isn't there? It's can be completely overwhelming and can paralyze you into I always make the analogy that I'm not a very good shopper. So if I go to like a big John Lewis, I'm just like, oh, I don't know. There's too much choice. Whereas if I go to, there's a Waitrose near me in Salisbury that just has a little bit of the John Lewis bit in it, and I can cope with that. And there's, because there's so many fewer choices, it's much easier. But when there's so much advice and so many, they're saying this, and it's just like, oh, you lose
yourself.
I completely
agree. I think probably you just have to pick something that resonates. And kind of run with it. But while being open to, a lot of people want to help, don't they? And I found that a lot of people want to help with advice, but it's harder to find people that want to help with practical elements, whether that's wrapping orders or sitting down and actually building the Excel spreadsheet. And the number of times people say, let's sit down for a coffee and I can try and talk through this, and I've actually started saying, you know what? No, because I don't need any more advice. I need to be doing now.
And I think that's the antidote almost to the overwhelm that can come with too much advice is action, isn't it? It's taking action. And I really love what you were saying about the realizing that need to have that maybe overall more strategic view and that more, having some plans and a better idea of the finances and being a bit more business-like sounds really wrong to say it, but that's
but it should sound wrong, and we shouldn't be scared to be business-like.
Yeah.
And and to be professional in that way. And, you know, doesn't have to mean being really cutthroat. It doesn't have to mean exploitative. It just means being sensible and focused on what the end goal actually is, or at least the end goal for that year.
Yeah,
that
definitely. So what that brings us quite nicely onto, what would your goals or your vision for Arende in the next year or two be?
Well, it's interesting that you've asked. So we, about 6 months ago, we launched a refugee sewing project in collaboration with the Refugee Council. And what we realised was that there was a huge market on both sides for this idea, both among refugees who wanted to work doing, you know, flexible sewing. Mm-hmm. It's very sort of culturally appropriate.
Yeah.
It's fun. They could learn English at the same time. It avoids the social isolation that a lot of refugees experience when they come to the UK. And on the other side, a lot of customers, and what I particularly found was hospitality customers that maybe wanted to buy into this and have products that were unique to them and that had this provenance and really positive backstory. And so what we've decided to do is formalize that as a sort of B2B part of the business, whereby hotels and restaurants can come to us with a specific need, whether that be napkins or tea towels or aprons or tissue box covers was an inquiry we had recently, and that we can provide support for refugees to create those things and employment and offer them out to industry. And it becomes it feels like this is an area of the business that has the potential to be possibly more profitable, mm-hmm. a bit faster than the B2C side of things. So the idea is to run them concurrently.
I was going to say, do you see them as two separate
They're sort of two separate elements of the business, but that are hugely beneficial to each other in terms of promoting each other, marketing to each other, and you know, the same ethos will apply to both. They'll just be the sort of sales element is slightly different. And you know, when I'm doing selling to consumers, I wrap everything by hand. Everyone gets a handwritten note, everyone gets a flower from the garden, everything's beautifully wrapped in a box. And that is, I love it. It's my passion, so that people feel, you know, this great joy when they unwrap something from Arende. But I can recognize that in terms of time, that isn't always my best use of time. And if a restaurant comes to us and said, look, you know, we'd like 200 tea towels, it's far less labor intensive to deliver those. And although the margins might be smaller on an individual item, the volumes are so much bigger that we can make more money. And so we have just done that for Petersham Nurseries, which is a lovely restaurant in Richmond, southwest London, which is opening a new restaurant in Covent Garden.
Wow.
They've been very supportive of us and been our kind of first big customer.
Yeah.
And we're also working with local chefs and got a couple of hotel inquiries in that we're working on. So that's the plan, I think, for this year is to really try and formalize that offering, get it up and running. And, it's not without its challenges working with refugees.
Sure.
That can be complex, finding premises, sourcing sewing machines, getting the right fabrics and ensuring that they're okay and the right quality. You know, all of those things are quite tricky. So probably what we will look at is employing a member of staff to actually manage project in its entirety, so that I can have step back and have more of an overview of the business now that the direct to consumer part of it is up and running.
So do you feel almost like that the interiors part, if we call it that, is at a point now where it needs to grow, but you've done that kind of hard graft first year, getting it up off the ground.
Up and running, we have the stock. I have a sense now of which things are selling. And, it's been a huge sort of educational process with the makers about how we should work and about consistency and quality and all of that kind of stuff. And so some of that is done now. And, you know, absolutely my passion is for people to have something lovely in their home that they can use every day. And that's not ever going to go away. So I would never stop that side of the business. But that I feel that's starting to gather a momentum of its own. Mm. And particularly on Instagram, it's I guess the sort of national press, it's starting to, I guess, just pay for itself. Mm.
Yeah.
Whereas the sewing project, I think, has this huge potential for social good, because I feel, and this may be overambitious, but I think it's a model that could be rolled out nationally.
Yeah.
Because I think that the demand is there. People, you know, hotels and restaurants, they want to be doing the right thing. And particularly if they're very committed to sourcing ethical food, then the logical next step is to say, well, hang on a minute. Where did these napkins come from?
Yeah.
Were they made in a sweatshop? Are they made out of fabric that has been good for the world? And so, you know, I think that that will be an area that we'll see people start to talk about more in terms of ethical businesses. And I just like to be at the forefront of it, but particularly with a model where we're employing people who find it hard to access the job market in the UK and who are incredibly committed and keen to work, but who just a bit of a flexible approach to make that step into employment.
Yes.
And so the project will run, you know, taking into account the people's individual circumstances. So if that's someone who wants to volunteer for 2 hours a week, that's fine.
Yeah.
And if it's someone who wants to earn money and do some of that home, then that's also fine. And, and we'll develop that and work out which bits work and which bits don't. And take it from there.
And did you say you're doing that? That's in conjunction with the Refugee Council?
Or? Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of loose collaboration with the Refugee Council and another local charity near where I live in St Albans, called Hearts Welcome Syrian Families, just because, you know, it's a group of people that have very specific needs and have often had very difficult histories. And I do not profess to be an expert in that experience or to necessarily know how best to approach it. So I need guidance on that, and we all need to find a way of working together. And obviously they're not business minded at all. They're very much more about wider life support. But that, you know, it, in terms of long term self-esteem and financial independence, it's very important to look at these kind of schemes that can help people on that path. And so it was important for me, as with all of the makers, to collaborate with an organization that has a credibility and to really advocate for their users, to make sure that we're not doing something where we're trying to help but we're actually causing more problems than we might be solving.
And isn't that interesting, because I suspect had I spoken to you a year ago, that wouldn't have even been on the agenda.
It wouldn't have crossed my mind.
Yeah.
No, because I wasn't in touch with any refugee groups. And it was only by launching that opportunity came about.
Yeah.
And so it's one of the things that's great about being a small business is that you can respond quite fast to these sorts of opportunities and you can really see where they go. And it will be interesting to see, I guess, what that leads to.
Yeah. And I guess it's about having a goal and, but not holding on to that specific outcome too tightly, maybe. So the wider goal, I guess, would be to change the way we consume and to ensure that it's, like you said, the things that we're buying aren't having a negative impact on everyone, rather than the goal being I'm going to set up a lifestyles shop that helps people. So it's about, I guess it's the why, isn't it? It's that deeper kind of, this is the end goal. This is the end, and all of these are stepping stones that will come together for it.
You have to be able to pivot, I think.
Yes.
That something is going to take you in a direction that is going to be more rewarding as an individual or financially beneficial for the business, then that's the thing to do. And I guess the thing for me is to marry the passions, which is about having a full collection, but is also about getting that message out to a wider audience. Because after all, if no one knows what you're doing, then it's really hard to have that positive impact. And so it just feels that running the two different types of enterprise alongside each other is a really sort of positive way of getting the word out and using the opportunities that have come up to benefit both sides.
Definitely. As I said, I could talk to you for hours and hours and hours, but I'm aware of time, and you've got small people as well, and a baby tortoise to look after.
Yeah.
So lastly, I guess, what would your advice be to anyone thinking about starting up their own ethical business, or maybe a few months into their startup journey?
That's a million-dollar question. Yes. I mean, I say keep going,
yeah,
but recognize that you can't do all of the things, mm-hmm. and apply that recognition in whatever way that needs to be done. And if that means that you don't get involved in that Twitter chat, yes. one evening because you need to see your children or your partner or go and yeah. do some exercise, yeah. then don't do it. You can't do all of the things mm-hmm. all of the time.
Yeah.
And outsource what you can in whatever way you can.
Yeah. And I think that even comes down to, you know, stuff around the house as well, isn't it? That, you know, can I outsource the cleaning to my husband? Oh, yes, I can.
The kids.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And the tortoise care. No, you don't want to outsource that. That's probably what you want.
That I enjoy.
Yeah, brilliant. Oh, this has been so useful, Emily, and thank you so much for being so transparent and so honest, because I think, as we said before we came on this call, that sometimes there's an element of fluff around it, and people tend to kind of maybe not want to admit that things aren't quite as bright and shiny and lovely as they and effortless as they might look on online, and you've been really honest about the challenges and, you know, how things are changing and adapting all the time, which I think is so useful.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, thank you. Take care.
You too.
You've been listening to the Making Good podcast with me, Jen Gale. If you've enjoyed the show, I'd really love you to pop over to iTunes to leave a review and say nice things. I'd also love to hear your feedback and your thoughts, so do drop me a line on jen@jengale.co.uk or head over to my Making Good community on Facebook. Thanks for listening.